Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of November. This particular show was planned for the day before Thanksgiving because I think in some ways it is a Thanksgiving story. Many of us have been touched by the story of Sandra Day O'Connor that was brought to national attention by Mr. and Mrs. O'Connor's son in an interview with a television station in Arizona. Mr. O'Connor has Alzheimer's, and of course, you'll remember that one of the reasons that she stepped down from the court was to be with him, to spend more time with him. What has happened is that her husband has a romance with another woman. The New York Times Week in Review section this Sunday had a moving story titled Love in the Time of Dementia, and it starts with this sentence, "So this, in the end, is what love is." Justice O'Connor is accepting of the romance that her husband is having with the other woman. She even visits with the couple while they are holding hands on the porch swing because, as the article states, it is a relief to see her husband of 55 years so content. We'll be looking at the relationships that often develop among Alzheimer's patients, new attachments, the desire for intimacy and closeness, even when a person has Alzheimer's and may not remember his or her family. And the reaction of Justice O'Connor, which is one of such incredible generosity and love, probably. We will have two guests with us during the course of this hour, Professor Ann Basting, director of the Center on Age and Community, and an associate professor in the Department of Theater at the Peck School of the Arts, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She has written extensively on issues of aging and representation, including her book, The Stages of Age, Performing Age in Contemporary American Culture. Her many articles and essays have been published across multiple disciplines, including journals like the Drama Review, American Theater, the Journal of Aging Studies, and many anthologies. She travels all over the country directing Time Slip's creative storytelling project, which she founded in 1998. She is working on a new book, Forget Memory, Imagining a Better Life for People with Dementia. And she teaches creativity and aging in special programs all over the country. Also joining us just momentarily will be Dr. Piero Antuono, who's a professor of neurology, pharmacology, and toxicology, and also director of the Dementia Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. I'll just give his bio now because he'll be joining us as we begin the conversation. This center is dedicated to research. He's dedicated to research in Alzheimer's disease and the Memory Disorders Clinic, which is a center for the clinical evaluation of patients who have memory problems. His specialty is adult neurology. Subspecialties are neuropharmacology of aging, Alzheimer's disease, and dementia. He received his MD at the University of Florence Medical School and directs investigational studies for the development of new drugs, as well as developing tests with MRIs for the identification of middle-aged people at future risk for development of Alzheimer's. I'm sure that many of you, like me, were very touched by the Sandra Day O'Connor story. You may be living your own, well, many of you are living your own stories, which we would like to hear. And we welcome your phone calls during this hour. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Ann Basting, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for including me.
What was your response when you saw that? I was just, every now and then you see something on television and it's so striking to you, and that story has stayed with me for a long period of time because of all that's involved in it. What did you think when you heard that story about Sandra Day O'Connor?
Well, I first heard it on NPR, actually.
Oh, really?
They did a piece on it. And my first response was, oh, the reason this is hitting the news, and actually emails had gone out to people who were spokespersons and researchers in the field saying, who can respond to this? I was really sad because I thought the initial response was from the son's interview with a television station in Arizona, and it became a news story because it was thought to be scandalous that, oh, this is infidelity. Oh, this is a big news item because Sandra Day O'Connor's husband is having an affair. And I thought, oh, why is this becoming such a huge issue? And then particularly, I mean, the NPR piece was fantastic. The New York Times article is one of the best pieces I've read about dementia and aging.
I loved it, too. And I just loved the article.
And there was just, all of a sudden, I thought, this is it. We're at the threshold where things are changing, and people are talking about the strengths of aging, you know, the difference between early love and late love, and I felt for the first time that really the dialogue in the press, too, that they were able to handle this in a really complicated way.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just, I started off being, you know, going, ugh, and then I completely switched to really thinking we're at a threshold moment.
I love the first line of this and comment on this, if you will. So this, in the end, is what love is. What she was doing, what he was doing, the girlfriend, the son, this is what love is in a very deep sense.
Yeah. It's a little ironic, that, and especially since Dr. Antuano is going to be joining us momentarily too. Last week on Monday, we hosted the Alzheimer's Association chapter in southeastern Wisconsin, of which I'm a board member, hosted a special screening of Away From Her, the film.
Oh.
It's actually also mentioned in that article.
I want to see that, yes.
Yeah. And Dr. Antuano and I did a talk back, and we really, a lot of the discussion afterward was about this. There's a very parallel situation to Sandra Day O'Connor's, Justice O'Connor's situation in Away From Her. And it really, as we were talking after the film, what it brings up is issues of what is commitment? What is faithfulness? What, across a long life? I mean, we're now living so much longer that one of the things that's adding a complication is that we never imagined we'd be married for 75 years, you know?
Right.
We never imagined that monogamy would mean, you know, that long. And through illnesses that are now, that are new to us, I mean, senility has been with us since the beginning of time, but the disease experience and living as long as we are is a completely new thing. So we're now seeing these issues coming up and being handled in complicated ways.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about the way that she has handled this. I'm wondering if one of the other reasons this becomes such a big story is that we can't imagine ourselves, and I'm sure this isn't across the board true, that everybody is as generous of spirit and loving as she is, and she's got reason to be mad. She gives up her seat on the Supreme Court, for heaven's sake, the other great love of her life, to care for him. And some people would say, and look what she gets in return, and instead you get this incredible generosity on her part. This phenomenal, and maybe it's an unusual kind of love, or is it unusual?
I don't think it's all that unusual.
Mm.
I think that when you see what Alzheimer's and dementia, other, you know, types of dementia can do to a relationship and to a person, that the pain of watching someone in pain and confusion and anxiety, really all you want is a relief to that. I mean, people give up and sacrifice their own health to care for someone at home, and that the opportunity to see someone happy, I mean, that's just all that she was hoping for, really, in my reading of the situation. I imagine that someone in that situation would just hope for relief of that anxiety, and it's a very difficult decision too to change if you've made the decision to do what a lot of people try to do, keep a person at home as long as possible, and then you reach that threshold where you have to make a change. You can't do it that way anymore. And she, from my understanding, had just moved her husband to assisted living. And wrestling with guilt about not being able to keep him at home, that the dual thing of then seeing him happy and adjusting well when the anticipation is that it could be a bad adjustment is just a tremendous relief. And making the visiting actually enjoyable to see him happy is going to enable her to be present and be there with him much longer, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a wonderful image, to be able to see somebody happy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what love is in old age? Is that what love is all the time, or is it more pronounced in old age?
Well, one of the things I loved about the New York Times article was that it said, you know, looking at love in the younger years as being really about being happy and the expectation of being happy and just being in this overwhelming tidal wave of being happy. And it's very physical, initial attractions, as you know, the evolutionary function of love. But then later in life, what does it become that intimacy becomes, can become, you know, the overwhelming feeling of simply breathing together or holding hands together, or, you know, when physical disabilities and cognitive disabilities challenge our notions of physical love, they become other things. And then also the sense that the article mentioned that late life love becomes about making someone else happy, about finding a way to leave legacy and spread love to other through other people. I thought it was really pretty a pretty eloquent way of saying it. The one thing I thought that is a cautionary note, though, is that not all of us get to that level of wisdom and selflessness.
Darn it. Right.
You know, there's still narcissists at 90. You know,
yes.
We're not all going to evolve our emotional life to that same level. So I do think that that it's not, well, it's not completely rare. You know, it's not also totally, you don't see it all the time.
Well, that's why it's nice to highlight this story, because it's something for all of us to think about, right?
Yeah.
What about physical love, though? What about physical love, and we'll talk more with Dr. Antuano about this, physical love among Alzheimer's patients, physical love among those who are aged in our society. We don't like to think of it, because we don't like to think about old people having sex.
I think it's a taboo, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely a taboo. I taught a class. I taught at University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh for a while and taught a class on intergenerational literature. And I showed the film Harold and Maude, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And in it, a very young man befriends and falls in love with a then 79-year-old woman, played by Ruth Gordon, absolutely deliciously. And they have sex, although they don't show it. They just show them in bed together, you know, in the same way that Away From Her has a scene between a couple in bed, but they don't show anything. And my students freaked out. They couldn't even think about the rest of the movie. You know, it was disgusting. And, I mean, the intergenerational component added a little twist, but I also am writing about Away From Her in this new book that you mentioned, and I've read a ton of reviews of it, and some of them focus in on that scene, and that's between two healthy older adults, you know, who are probably in their 70s, played by phenomenal actors, and all they show is the heads above the sheets, right after this happens, you know, and they're kind of laughing and are shocked at what's happened, and the reviewers, freaked out just as much as my students. They just do not want to imagine it. But I think it's really crucial for us to tell ourselves that our own need for intimacy, for physical touch, for emotional support through physical relationships and intimate relationships, that's never going to go away for us. We can't imagine that will go away for us. But for some reason, when we think of other people and from the outside and looking at it from the outside, we cannot tolerate it. But to me, it's a comfort to know that that doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
It means the core of who I am is going to stay there across my life.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if all of that will change just as we get more and more people who are very old in our society. We're only going to increase those numbers, and by golly, it would be a much more comforting image to have of growing old, knowing that you retain that kind of physical intimacy and love.
I think so, too, and I think, you know, we hear a lot, did you know the baby boomers were aging?
I sure did.
We hear that a lot,
right?
That the baby boomers are going to change everything. And to me, that drives me crazy, because I think, can't we change it now? Can't we be part of it, everybody? But I think that the reason it's going to change is not just the numbers of people, but also what's called the cohort issue, the type of generational context in which they grew up. which was much more open about sexuality, much more sort of expecting that sex is a part of your life, and that's what's going to help change things. I think that generationally, the cohort that is right now older had very different views about the privacy issues and about being open about sexuality and the appropriateness of sexuality in some settings. And I think we're going to see a change.
We're going to pause for just a moment. And when we return, Dr. Antuono will also be joining our conversation. And we gave his bio a little bit earlier, but he is director of the Dementia Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin and has worked in this area for a long period of time. He's also president of the World Federation of Neurology Dementia Research Group. Here's our phone number. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Ann Basting is also joining us. Her expertise is in cultural representations of aging, particularly memory loss and dementia. She is director of the Center on Age and Community at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And she fosters innovations in aging built on partnerships between care providers and researchers across multiple disciplines, from architecture and nursing to the arts and social work. To your phone calls in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And before we go to phone calls, let me welcome Dr. Piero Antuono's to our conversation, ask him just a couple questions, and then we will move right to you. Dr. Antuono, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. Oops, there we go. I got the wrong mic up. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us. Could we talk just a little bit about what happens to us physically, what's happening in the brain in terms of the emotional attachments that we may have, even though we may not be able to remember those close to us, but this need to connect with other human beings, from what you have said to me, Sandra Day O'Connor's husband, is not unusual in this regard, that we still want to reach out and have that kind of attachment with somebody, even though it may not be our partner of many years.
Yes, as has been mentioned, this is not a very easy issue, but it's really based on some principles that I think we all agree on when we deal with people who have dementia. As this condition progresses and people's memory becomes dissolved, and language also follows suit, so that expressing one ideas becomes complicated. It doesn't mean that we lose our basic emotions in regards to wanting to be part of a group, wanting to have a companionship. And this is expressed in many ways, as mentioned earlier, including intimacy. And we see this in dealing with people who have dementia on a daily basis, that we shift more from conversation and using language to more smiling and touching and reassuring by ways that all people can understand, even if language becomes a problem. Because this is a universal language, the way of reaching people's needs and emotions through body language. We use that even therapeutically to make sure that the person, for instance, understands that we are in happy with the current situation, everything is under control, and you can communicate that to the patient without really using words, just by your behaviors. So that the nonverbal communication, but the emotional aspect of communicating with people with dementia becomes even more so important. But at the same time, we need to be also more sensitive in understanding that they're trying to express themselves also with in a similar manner, and they look for companionship and for intimacy with their companion or with closeness with another human being as part of really expression of who we really are, which are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as was mentioned by Dr. Basting earlier, you cannot separate that just because somebody is now older or has a disease like Alzheimer's disease. That it's really part and core of humanity, I think.
And yet, one of the things that strikes me about her story, and I'm sure it does other people as well, is that it's hard. Most of us can't love that much. Most of us would be maybe jealous of this other relationship, even though our family member has Alzheimer's. The fact that you had spent 55 years with someone and your loved one no longer remembers you, to have that kind of he's happy now, so that makes me happy, still strikes me as rather extraordinary, and that we have a long way to go in helping family members understand what you were just saying.
Because although we appreciate having been married 55 years with somebody, we lack the perspective of having had Alzheimer's disease for 10 years, and what does that to the companion, to the caregiver?
Mm-hmm.
So she's bringing in her expression of happiness in seeing him happy, all of the trials and tribulations of seeing him gradually decline and becoming more isolated, and also herself feeling isolated, not having the relationship she had before with her husband, and realizing that she's now in charge of everything, that the gradual, you know, she will remember very well the periods of anxiety and feeling lost that the husband must have experienced, and the sense of lack of control and loneliness that he must have had, and fright sometimes. And now reaching that stage where she sees him being content because he has a companionship that otherwise he would not have in a group home. You know, you are pleased of that because you have to go through all of those 5, 6, 10 years of as I said earlier, of finding the best way to improve his quality of life. So mm-hmm. when you see that at the end, you see that it's a help you're getting, actually, rather than quote-unquote competition or something that is stressful.
Mm-hmm. And these kinds of attachments that are formed, and they would be in more community settings like nursing homes, assisted living facilities, would it be a temporary kind of attachment? Would there be attachments to more than one person? Is there any kind of trend that you can discern, having studied Alzheimer's and what's going on in the brain? Are they short-lived attachments? What's going on with that?
Well, in the original article, actually, that the story of Judge O'Connor was reported, the person at the group home mentioned that out of 48 residents, there are 3 similar situations.
Mm.
So that kind of gives us an idea of the frequency of this phenomena. And I would say that this special attachments, just like the word seemed to imply, it's a special person with whom this person recognizes that there is a connection. And it could be because this person might have had a smile or a friendly connection or touch, or maybe they resemble somebody.
Oh.
And so that there is this kind of bonding, which in somebody who has dementia, whereby you might not remember what has happened a minute ago and have no idea what is a minute from now. You live right here in the immediate present. When you see that friendly face, all of a sudden you have a sense of safeness, of safety, of connectedness, that you are in peace with the world because your point of reference, your security blanket, or whatever you want to call that, it's there. And so I think the nature of the disease itself lends to these attachments in a certain way, because you have lost your past history, and you are not aware of the future. And so even more so, you see this person as a fulcrum, like a point of reference for mm-hmm. your immediate existence on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for both of you. All our lines are filled. And if you'd like to send an email, we'll give you that address as well, which is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. We start our calls with Bob from Mequon. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Fine program. We appreciate it very much. My wife has dementia, and we have had a wonderful long period of cognition in which she's been healthy and relatively happy and good relationship. I just want to contrast the relationship you discussed of Sandra Day O'Connor with another solution, which was the Ronald Reagan solution, which Miss Nixon kept the president at home, and he was within the family throughout the whole process. I'd just like your guests to comment on not maybe the better solution, but how it would appear to them of the two have handled this situation.
Yeah, good question. Thank you very much, Bob, for your call. Who wants to start?
I'll address that a little bit. I think that there's, we still have, and for sometimes for very good reason, a real resistance to having someone go to a facility, whether it's a nursing home or assisted living, that we really want to keep the person home as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
One of the real negative things, and that we're seeing in the research, and Dr. Antuano can speak to this too, is that social interaction is is one of the biggest preventative things and treatment mechanisms for people to improve quality of life and even sometimes cognition, that that social engagement with other people is so important. And the thing that can be sad about keeping someone at home at all costs is that largely what they're doing is watching television and not engaging with other people, partially because, you know, we have, as a culture, we don't know how to interact with people, and so friends stop visiting. Family, it's painful for family. Sometimes they don't want to come visit. And so that you can end up with real severe social isolation by having someone stay at home. And, you know, a happy medium of the incredible adult day services that we have in this country now of having social interaction during the day and then being able to care for the person at home, or assisted living or even skilled nursing where the community is, where there's an open door so that the social engagement with family doesn't stop, and that they're part still of the community of care is probably a middle ground. I don't know enough about how many visitors Reagan had or things like that, but it did seem to me that he was behind a veil, a curtain that we, you know, that the disease experience was pretty isolated. So, again, I can't compare them directly, but those are the two general types and the cautions I would give about, you know, staying at home at all costs.
Yeah. We also have to make certain, though, that all of those facilities that you mentioned are top-notch facilities, and we have a long way to go in this country in that regard.
Of course.
Yeah. Dr. Antoine, you want to comment on that as well?
Yes. I think the different ways of providing care for somebody at home versus in a group depends on the ability of the caregiver to provide an adequate and safe environment. Mm-hmm. Frequently, the caregiver also is an elderly person who might have health problems, mm-hmm. who may not lift the person from the floor if he falls down. So there are some really practical physical limitations that may demand one type of care versus the other. Cost is another important aspect of it. But mostly it's safety for the patient and the mental and physical stamina of the caregiver to stay there day after day, night after night, to provide that level of care that might determine, well, there is a breaking point. I cannot provide this any longer. And there's not one preferred model, but I fully agree with the socialization, which is important in people who have progressive dementia. And couples where one has dementia, they become socially isolated. Mm-hmm. Friends are afraid to bother them. They see them busy. They shy away. We are reminded of our own mortality when we go and visit, so that's another reason why people shy away. And frequently people find themselves isolated. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for the immediate family providing the companionship, even the caregiver would become surrounded by basically loneliness in regards to providing the care she has to provide.
Mm-hmm. I would think that it's an incredibly difficult position to be in, to be a caregiver of someone with Alzheimer's, that it's just got to be so demanding, and that breaking point can be a big breaking point. What a hard thing to do.
Yes, in fact, people are studying what happens to caregivers, and it's an object of research which is pretty active. And there are some conclusions that they've noticed that people who care for Alzheimer's patients have twice as many visits to their family doctors. Mm. They use twice as many antidepressant medications. Mm. They're twice as more likely to be admitted to a hospital for some medical complication. Mm-hmm. I think because of this wear and tear, of this continued presence and never letting go in regards to the surveillance that one lives in, that takes its toll.
Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that, Dr. Basting, as well?
On what
happens to the caregivers? Yeah,
I think that's really true. I think that we're getting better at finding ways to support them. There's a lot of research happening in this area. We're starting to look for the systems of care and support rather than focusing on the person with dementia alone, if they're living at home and they're in our system here, say, with family care. They're also looking at the caregiver. At the same time, you're looking at the partnership and the health needs there to keep that partnership going, to help enable them, if they want to stay at home, to stay at home, so that you don't just look at one side of it, that it's a relationship that you're looking at preserving. And I also think that the Alzheimer's Association has incredible programs. It's much more the cultural hesitation to sort of open themselves up to saying, I need this. Our denial is an incredible mechanism that keeps us from getting the help and support that we need. Even there are people who don't even say they've been caring for a loved one at home for quite a while, and they don't even consider themselves caregivers, so they wouldn't go get help because they don't even see themselves as being in that role.
What do they see themselves as?
I don't know, just being a spouse. That's just what a spouse does, or a child, or mom just needs a little help. I'm not a caregiver. But say an adult child is actually managing a very complex system of care and doesn't consider themselves to be a caregiver. So it's really, there's a lot of public education that has to happen. There's a lot of help out there already, but people don't necessarily identify with it or recognize it.
Let's go back to phone calls. Eileen from Oshkosh is next. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. My parents were married 60-plus years.
Oh, my.
Yes, and had a wonderful, wonderful marriage and life. And even at the 60th anniversary celebration, you could see my dad was faltering a bit. And it came to a point where my mother could no longer take care of him at home. I think comparison with Reagan is totally apples and oranges, because they had the money to be able to have tons of care, tons of people around him, probably had physical therapy, you know, the whole gamut, and she was able to go around as she pleased, come and go, where in a situation in a regular income family, that's not possible to have full-time round care, which I'm sure that he actually did.
Mm-hmm.
And so the spouse could go as they please. When we put my dad in a facility, it wasn't for a very long time, that he did make a connection to another person, a woman. He followed her around, and you know, I think taken out of the home in such a broad way where you can't really explain it to them and they can't give you answers of how they're feeling about it, they do make the attachment because they feel, well, this is like their wife. I don't feel that it is an affair. Sad to say, the family that the woman that he did make this special attachment to and just, you know, wanted to be close to her and near her and stuff like that and follow her around, didn't appreciate that and didn't understand that relationship. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't but shortly, maybe after that, that the facility decided to separate the men from the women.
Oh, my.
And I thought that was so unfair because such an different situation from really a family situation. Up to that point, you know, I was very, very happy with the care he did, and he did receive, and I still was. But, you know, I did really fight it. I said, you know, this is just not right. It's not normal to be just in an all-man's unit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently it didn't work out for him to be in this all-man's unit either. He was a very passive, kind person. He did not get violent in his older age. And so it wasn't long after that it seemed like some of the more aggressive men hit him.
Oh, my.
And so they then eventually just took him out and put him in a regular old folks home, or, you know, in a different unit, which was just the aging, I should say, the aging elderly unit, you know. So
what a story, Dr. Antuono.
Yes. Well, this is always a challenge for the staff in a group home, nursing home, because really the ageism, the point of view shared earlier in the program, that young people don't see old people as having sexuality, it's also shared by staff. We're not really specifically trained in this area. If some attachment is present among people who have dementia, there is an issue, of course, of are they competent and are they aware of what's going on, or are they victimized by one of the two?
Mm-hmm.
And the staff has to make that judgment. And the families have to both be aware and, how we say, in a certain way, agree with this relationship developing. But if one of the families, who, by the way, have legal guardianship on the patient, decides that this is not what they want, well, then, unfortunately, that relationship generally does not continue. Mm-hmm. Now, why one family decides one way, the other one the other, is again, as I mentioned earlier, because the caregivers come with their history, their culture, their background, and they have a different endpoint in assessing this issue. There are some nursing homes who have specific written guidelines on how to deal with these specific attachments, actually.
Hmm.
And again, the major difference is whether the resident is competent or not competent to allow them to have, or in the second case, to assess if the attachment is an appropriate one.
Mm-hmm. And how do you assess competency?
Well, I think although there are some kind of common norms in seeing if the person knows who they are and where they are and so forth, but I think it's really a specific history of that individual as perceived by the staff in the nursing home and in discussions with the family that one can understand, is this something that the patient with Alzheimer's disease is receiving a benefit from this relationship. I'm trying not to answer your question as you're figuring out, because it's not an easy question to make. You have standard forms or standard approaches to discuss competency, but once we've done that, we still need to see if this is a benefit for the patient's quality of life, having this relationship.
Mm-hmm. And you can certainly see that particular story, and there are so many like it, Dr. Bastien, being translated into film or movie or stories so that we get a better understanding of this. These are new stories to us, I think, in large measure.
I think they're new to the media. I don't think they're
right.
new at all
right.
to the general public. I think the reason your phone lines are probably all lit up is because it's a pretty common story. A couple of twists I wanted to add on just what Dr. Antoine was saying and what the caller was saying, too, is, and one of the things when you're looking at a facility, if that's a decision you're having to make, is they should be open and able to talk with you about these kinds of situations and how they handle them.
Mm-hmm.
If they respond solely for the needs of the staff over the needs of the residents,
mm-hmm.
that's not a place you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we had this thing in 1987 called the OBRA. It was that really overhauled all the regulations in nursing homes and has a very distinct, Bill of Rights for residents that says we're to preserve dignity, choice, and self-determination. It gets a little tricky when, cognitive disability comes in because it's difficult to know what choice is. But I think in the situation where whose right is it to take away consenting, what appears to be a consensual, mutual, not harmful relationship, sometimes it's really the families that are the most uncomfortable with these kinds of things. And part of it can be a sense at the end of life of spiritual and religious issues that suddenly this may seem like infidelity, which is a sin.
Right.
How is that going to damage, my religion and my view of what's going to happen in the afterlife to my partner, which may be, or my husband or wife, which may be very, very important to me? We don't have a good track record in religion and spiritual issues of handling these exact issues. In fact, our language can be pretty backward in those situations of trying to help family members cope with this by saying things like, well, he's really not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that language can be damaging, too, because then the person is there. It's a really gray new area that people are struggling with to come to terms with. One other thing, too, is that we've mainly focused on spouses, but one of the most painful things can be a child, an adult child, a 60-70-year-old child, dealing with the fact that my father or my mother is holding hands with someone who's not my, father or mother.
Right.
And really having to challenge your own views of your relationship with your parent can be very, very challenging for people. And in situations that I've talked with people who've encountered these kind of situations, they say that that's oftentimes the children who are the most uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is, thank you so much for the call, Eileen, 800-486-8655-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Dr. Piero Antuono, who is a professor of neurology, pharmacology, and toxicology, director of the Dementia Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the Memory Disorders Clinic, a center for the clinical evaluation of patients who have memory problems. His specialty is adult neurology, and he has a number of subspecialties as well. Also joining this conversation is Dr. Ann Basting, director of the Center on Age and Community and an associate professor in the Department of Theater at the Peck School of the Arts, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She has performed extensively on the stages of age, performing age in contemporary American culture, and she's written a number of essays across multiple disciplines. She is currently at work on a new book, Forget Memory, Imagining a Better Life for People with Dementia. All right, more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, back to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Bill from Oshkosh is next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I think this is a wonderful program, and I wish I'd heard it much earlier. My father and my uncle, unrelated by blood or genetically, both had what we would call experiences, I think, of kind of inappropriate physical behavior toward members of the opposite sex. And it created quite some tension in the family. My uncle, I guess, went to a full-time nursing care, Evergreen Manor. And my father, though, you know, kind of refused, wasn't confronted on it because we were so embarrassed about it, but he sort of refused any kind of intervention that we suggested to take more care of him. And when he passed away, shortly thereafter, maybe a year or so, I found in his upper drawer a psychologist report that I'd kind of requested through his doctor, who said, well, you know, your dad's the type, if we have him tested for his driver's license, you'll probably drive anyway. He said it's happened a number of times, and sure enough, in the drawer were a statement that my father should not drive, probably, and his psychologist report, and probably should not handle money, both of which he did. In fact, he died just after driving us to lunch.
Oh, my.
You know, exactly. But he maintained contact with other people by going out to lunch where all the staff knew him at various places. And his friends, when they were there, would call him and take him out. But he initiated very little social interaction. So I think there's this kind of triangle that goes on, a resistance by the person to take him or her to treatment, and difficulties in recognizing what is inappropriate behavior and should be, you know, that somebody really needs lack of judgment, they really should need some sort of care or work. On the other hand, the kind of stigma of the physical, and which is why this program is so good, because I think it's normal, kind of more normal behavior than we would like, but also the importance of the social interaction, which was very hard to get my father to do, unless the irony was you'd institutionalize him where you'd think you'd have less, but maybe more. I mean, mm-hmm. I just find this discussion kind of liberating, but there's still some dilemmas out there.
There are a lot of dilemmas, Dr. Antuono, you want to start?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, yes, the patient has to be looked at through his history and address his needs specifically to address issues related to safety. In the case reported, you know, he was kind of a person who was his own person in many ways and had his own ideas, and in a certain way those recommendations were not sort of put in place. But I think it's providing, you know, care for somebody like him or in general to people with dementia, it's something that needs to be titrated and adjusted almost on a continuum, so that what we decided to not to discuss and put in place, maybe driver's recommendation or concerns at least, then maybe 6 months from now they need to be acted upon. And maybe today the person may not need socialization and interaction because he has a modicum of that, and then maybe because he has the will to say, I don't want that. But then maybe a year from now, then is the time to consider participation in adult daycare centers or senior centers. So that what the caller was reporting is some of the challenges in the deciding what kind of care to provide at what time in the course of the disease.
Yes.
And unfortunately, there's not a specific standard answer to that question. You
mm-hmm.
have to sort of learn as you go.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Basing, would you respond?
I think we got to work on the options for people from both directions. You know, some people say, let's just blow up all the nursing homes. That's not the solution, because in some situations we really need them. But we have to work on making them more person-centered and more a place where we know that person's choices and autonomy and dignity are going to be preserved, and
mm-hmm.
that decisions aren't only made for staff convenience, but for that person. And yet also, the thing I really like about the caller's story is that in a way, his treatment plan was using the restaurants.
Right.
And imagine a world,
yeah.
imagine a culture if we move, and I think we're moving in that direction, where, say, the local art museum, the local historical museum, the institutional structures that we all use, if the staff were knew about memory loss and dementia and understood and were open and accessible to people, so that the institutions in our culture as they are now are part of the care plan. Instead of having people be afraid of someone who's losing language or might become confused, that they understand what it is and can help and be part of that person's community.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to work in both directions to make someone whose choice is to live at home try to be as independent as possible. To be able to make that work up to a certain extent, and to make have there be more options for that choice, as well as have the option of living in a facility, be sure that people can live meaningful lives there.
Right. Oh, you have such a creative mind. I like I like this. Let's go to Milda from Menominee. Hello, Milda.
Hello.
Hi.
excuse me. My husband had Alzheimer's. I found that I denied it for as long as I could, but my son recognized things, and a doctor confirmed things, and we moved to Menominee, and Hugh lived with me in the apartment for maybe a year or longer, and this is a facility where we have our noon meal. So he was with other people at noon every day. He didn't want to go shopping with me or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to put in a word for the caregiver, because after a while, I would find Hugh, in the morning, I would find that I had slept through and that he was entirely dressed and lying on the bed. Or sometime about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he would turn on the light looking for clothes and wake me up. I was getting exhausted.
I'm sure.
So finally we did decide. And I must say, I feel he had splendid care. I think those people are saints. The way they can adjust, because there's not just one form of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was a physicist. He didn't take exercises, but he mowed a huge lawn and walk to work. And so the things that people say to do Well, I don't know. Maybe his was delayed a little while, but it certainly didn't keep him from getting it.
Yeah. Thank you, Milda, so much for your call. And that seems an appropriate place for us to end this show because it's an appropriate call and we have to end this show. Thank you both so much for being with us and for the work that you do. I'm really pleased to have had you with us. Dr. Antuono, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and thank you, Dr. Basting, as well. Thanks for the work you're doing.
My pleasure.
Yeah, our guests, Dr. Ann Basting, Director of the Center on Age and Community, Associate Professor, Department of Theater, Peck School of the Arts, UW-Milwaukee. Dr. Antuono, Professor of Neurology, Pharmacology, Toxicology, Director of Dementia Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We'll have him on again to talk more about the medical aspects of Alzheimer's and dementia. Okay, everybody, have a really good Thanksgiving. I'll be with you again on Monday. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and for on-air production, and thanks for all of your calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.